Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
What's good, internet? It is Austin Walker. It is October.
This is the first time you've done this. You've never done a date intro.
I know, that's why I'm bumbling it. But here's the thing: is the last time we did an intro, the weather was really bad, and so I was just like focused on that. Today, the weather is like that exact perfect New York fall weather. So all I can think about is like, oh, it's October. It's exactly the platonic ideal of an October day in New York right now. So I'm focused. I want to say October. You know.
It's beautiful out here too. So maybe we're gonna jinx this, and then 15 minutes from now, it's gonna become a torrential downpour. But right now, we both have nice weather. I'm gonna try and enjoy it.
It is extra beautiful in here today because I have a special guest, and he's covering his face right now and wiping sweat from his brow. Harvey Smith is joining us, surprise guest.
Hey guys, very happy to be here, and very happy it's October, my favorite month.
Is it because of Halloween? Is it because of the weather?
You know, growing up in Texas, my family spent half their time on the Gulf Coast because that's where one part was from, and half the time in Central Texas, which both are hot, and one's really hot and muggy. And so somehow, you know, after these summer days where sometimes it's over 100 for 30 days straight or whatever, it's oppressive. And so somehow when that first turn of autumn happens and a cold front comes in, it just feels like magic to me. And then it signals the coming of Halloween and the holidays and all
right.
that. It's wonderful.
Lots of masks, lots of...
Yeah.
I'm curious, how is Halloween in the part of the country where you were from? Is it like a big deal? Do people like go all out? Is there lots of decoration?
Yeah, spook houses and setting your house up like a haunted house or whatever. Having big parties, everybody being in costume. Like, you know, it's maybe more a function of age than anything. Like, in December I turned 50, which is astounding to me. growing up in the 70s, like, I was surrounded by all these aunts who are younger, who are like, you know, would go all out for all the cousins
right.
and stuff and dress as witches and cats and et cetera and put black plastic trash bags up in the garage to make a little labyrinth or whatever. We'd bob for apples, all that stuff. We'd go trick-or-treating. You know, the rumors of like poison pixie sticks and razor blades and apples and all that was like, that was exactly when people were talking about all
right.
that, but it was still so much fun, you know.
I'm sure there are people listening at home thinking like, of course this dude loves Halloween. Look at the games he's made. Look at the games that he's been part of. Like, these are spooky things sometimes. These are lots of masks. Very intricate masks sometimes, and lots of spook houses in the sense that, like, let me build something that has a specific effect in mind. That
I thought we were just shooting the breeze, but you're going
boom.
Deep.
Looks good.
Yeah, so, Austin Walker's equivalent of shooting the breeze.
It is.
No,
like,
I love it.
Who else am I going to ask that question to?
I have spent a lot of time thinking about horror and coping with things and mastery of scary feelings that you have when you're a child and how we make it into something that we can like get our heads around by making it a creature from the Black Lagoon or a werewolf or whatever.
Instead of something
exactly.
else, right? Like that's the uncanny terror.
Some of my favorite type of horror is more like that. Like one of my favorite horror movies is Ginger Snaps, the film about teenage girls that become werewolves, mm-hmm. you know, and what they're all the stuff in their world they're coping with, you know, and so horror as an allegory for that sort of thing, instead of like fetishistic horror that's just made to creep you out or mm-hmm. disturb you or whatever, I'm much more like the former than the latter.
Do you think that even, and maybe Patrick knows this just as well as he is, Patrick is the biggest horror buff I know, do you think even the stuff that doesn't necessarily frame itself as being about something actually reflects some other anxiety? Like, obviously something like Babadook or It Follows, it's very easy to be like, oh, yeah, okay, here's the thing. But even the B movie, even the slasher flicks, even the sort of like schlocky horror that is just trying to make you have a jump scare. Is there something lingering there too, just harder to dig out, or maybe even something that the creators weren't aware of in some cases?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's one of my favorite forms of criticism, is the sort of after the fact analysis of what was really going on there, whether the creator was conscious of it or not. I mean, you could look at the James Whale films, Frankenstein films, uh-huh. and talk about his the fact that he was gay in Hollywood at a time when it wasn't widely accepted, you know. And you could look at zombie films. We just finished like a decade-long obsession with zombie films, and you could talk about fear of crowds uh-huh. and fear of shortages and mobs and maybe race relations in there somewhere, but also...
That's certainly the classic zombie thing,
yeah,
right?
Like fear of death, fear yeah. of disease. It's like that stuff is way more fascinating to me than just the. I guess all of it. You're right. It's fascinating for somebody. Each one is probably right. interesting to somebody. But
wait to see if Patrick, who is our horror expert, had a weigh in here. Because I know Patrick. Yeah. One of the things with you is like you do just say, no. Like I love being scared. I love goofy horror movies.
Well, the argument I've always made as I've sort of like done a, you know, when I was growing up, I think, you know, when you're examining what you're afraid of and what you respond to, it's often is that surface level. It's, you know, the slasher flick. It's the scary monster, Freddy Krueger or Jason Voorhees. But as I got older and I continued to enjoy horror films, once you reach your late 20s, you got to have a sit down with yourself and like, what is it about this that you're responding to? And it's fine to enjoy it just on the sort of fetishistic surface level. You know, I think there is room for just the jump scare. But for me specifically, I enjoy watching films that sort of force me. I find horror to be a place to confront my own fears of death, to get like super serious for a second, right?
Cool.
But it is that place where, you know, like if you are, let's say, claustrophobic, which it's not a phobia of mine, but it is definitely one of my deepest fears. So films that play upon that, I find to be deeply uncomfortable, but also a space to sort of explore the things that freak you out in safe space. And so those often tend to be my favorite films that sort of prey upon sort of a specific feeling that may not be universal, but for those particular people, it becomes something very powerful.
I completely agree. And that's to bring it back to games. I mean, I think a large part of the games that I love, they have empty atmospheric spaces that you're free to explore at your own pace mm-hmm. and with your own movement. Like, I don't like creepy atmospheric spaces where the camera's super constrained or whatever. Just picking a couple of examples, like from Stalker to Fallout, you know, or yeah. Far Cry 2 or Bioshock or Thief or System Shock.
You're in the best possible place. Like, it's either this or the Idle Thumb Studios, but either this or that is the place for the list of games you just listed.
Oh, maybe Rock, Paper, Shotgun, too.
Maybe Rock, Paper, Shotgun. Yes, but, yes. They love themselves some Stalker.
In any case, like, there's just a combination of things. There are scary, menacing people out or things out there, and you can't reason with them. It's not like you can always stop and just they explain themselves. They have a viewpoint that is so alien to you or so hostile to you that there's no reasoning with them. You have to either avoid them or confront them, master them, you know. The atmosphere itself is beautiful at moments, but it's also unnerving and yeah. sparsely populated. And it's, you know, you can get on the ruins of a building and look down below and feel powerful, or you can be like creeping through an alley. And, you know, so Rafael Colantonio is a co-creative director and founder of Arcane Studios, and he and I talk a lot about where these sort of drives come from and why we're so fascinated with them still to this day. And have we exercised those demons, or now we just like playing with the flavors that
right.
we like, or, you know, is it still a need?
Because like, is there a point like to kind of weave back in what Patrick was saying? We can talk about confronting some of these things in a space that is safe, and we can talk about using them in a way that it's like exploratory. But I do wonder sometimes if in the process of pouring ourselves into making them good and fun to play and coherent, we end up losing the original drive that pushed us there and enshrining the result separate from intention, separate from, so like to get specific in some way, it's like, is there, let's like do the biggest, worst example, which is like the blood scrawled on the wall that says something. Like, I promise the first person who did that had a lot of thought behind why they were doing it. But at this point, anytime I see blood graffiti, or anytime that I hear an audio log that's like trying to do exposition, but not necessarily in a way that helps present the world, the fiction of the world, or even something like the jump scare, which like originally comes from a deep understanding of audiences and the position of an audience member watching a film and feeling safe and not feeling embodied, like feeling separate from their body, and the jump scare brings you right back down into the body. Like that stuff starts at a place that's really informed and really specific and particular, and then goes to like, oh yeah, of course we have jump scares. Oh yeah, of course we have blood graffiti.
Yeah, those things become tropes, or they just become the tool set, you know, in a game creation. But I don't
think... How do you check yourself?
I don't think genres are bad, and I don't think recognizable, familiar tools to the audience are bad, as long as some other part of the work is elevated or you reach people, you know? I would not be the guy who's gatekeeping that, you know, like never put an audio log in a game ever again, or never put any graffiti on the wall, because every now and then someone exceeds like my expectations about it. You know, like Left 4 Dead is one of my favorite games, mm-hmm. and the safe, what do they call them at the end of level?
It's like safe rooms.
Yeah, the safe houses.
Safe houses.
Yeah.
Safe houses. Yeah. It's just such a brilliant convention where the media that you're working from and the game play like dovetail together, you know, and it's...
Right.
And it's like this little moment of pull-based storytelling, and it was so heartfelt. The first time I, you know, went into a safe room and I started reading the messages from different people. But
yeah, so, for people who haven't played that game in a while, who maybe missed it, at the end of each level, you know, you kind of battle your way through a cityscape or a rural landscape and wind up in a safe house, and then there are just messages scrawled on the walls. And often there can be little B-plots that are working their way through those messages from safe house to safe house, even from level to level. Even through the style of writing, you start recognizing that these are characters, and
yeah,
that's
Austin,
really great.
Are you saying that you might have listeners who have never played Left 4 Dead?
Oh, sure.
Like,
listen,
oh my God.
I hope.
Get out and play Left 4 Dead. It's so brilliant.
Listen, I hope we have listeners who've never played. I hope we have listeners who haven't played a game in a decade, right? Mm. But are interested in. There's a writer here, Larry Fitzmaurice, who is not at Vice Gaming, but is at Vice.com. He's a culture writer. And I like sending things for him to edit, because he used to play games like all of the time, hasn't in about a decade, but still reads blogs, still reads critics, still has his head in the world of games, because he thinks they're a fantastic and interesting way to tell stories and offer exploration. So I hope we have people who are like, oh, is Left 4 Dead that game where you shoot a bunch of zombies? And then we get to tell them, like, actually,
yeah.
The use of text messages on the walls, the use of kind of the barks, the character barks back and forth that are, like, automatic when you start walking through a place. What the dude who's, like, a biker who just hates everything is like, yeah. I hate trains, is the best. And, like, that stuff is a big part of, I think, why that game was successful. If it was just the zombie shooting sim, it wouldn't be as strong.
Yeah, it's the, when it works, you know, it's like narrative and game mechanics working together, because I think if it was just the narrative, it would probably also fail. But because, you know, it frustrates me a little bit when people start talking about games and what they're capable and what they're possible, you know, what's possible for them to do, and they end up just talking about the visuals and the narrative.
Sure.
You know, sometimes. And Left 4 Dead is this beautiful symphony of things, you know, like there are mechanics in it that I don't think get enough attention. Like, if you're running from zombies and one of them hits you, it slows you a tiny bit. And so the more zombies that are hitting you, the more it slows you. And it simulates that being dragged down by the mob, which is classic. And how do you do that in first person? They figured it out. And then they added the controller mechanic where you like automatically do a 180 to face back the way you were coming, which gets around the mouse look problem. And also like suddenly you're face to face with the group that's pulling you down. And then they, of course, did all the co-op mechanics that were like just so overt, but once you get used to them as sort of the codes or the way you interact with this game is you know, like you're, you know, the first time I was stuck at a ledge, like I got too close to a ledge and I fell. And you know what it looks like from your perspective, the person is outlined, they're crying out automatically, the character is like, hey, somebody give me a hand, help. you know, the first time it happens to you and you just feel helpless, like, come on, dude, I can mantle up or I can pull myself up on a ledge in any other game. Why am I trapped here? But it's like, I guess the team realized, like, if we're going to make a co-op game, we have to force some co-op, you know, and it's it gives you all these dynamic drama moments where you're like, I could fight the zombies on the roof here, or I could run back over and pull this guy up off the ledge. I need to do that or else the team's screwed. And once one person goes down, it's a positive feedback loop. It gets worse and worse for us. So I'm going to go rescue this guy. Mm-hmm. Just a brilliant
game. Really great. You know, that reminds me, actually, and the way you speak about mechanics in general, one of the things that struck me this year at E3 was, first of all, E3 this year, like, pretty much broke down the on-stage presentations anyway into kind of three categories, I think, which was the kind of Sony style, which was like orchestral swells, no one on stage, here's the gameplay, it speaks for itself, here's a trailer, this is all we're going to say about it, the end. Or catch us after for an interview. Then there was the kind of the other style, which was at a bunch of different presentations, which where it was some people on stage who spoke briefly, then a gameplay trailer that spoke, again, tried to speak for itself, and then cut quick out, you know? But at Bethesda, you know, at their stage show, you went up for 20 minutes and talked through a playthrough of Dishonored 2 and got into the nitty-gritty, talked about systems, talked about the way systems interacted. Was that like, was that meant to be this alternative choice, or was that just the obvious way for you to do it? Did you just like, oh yeah, of course this is what we're going to do?
You're talking about the Bethesda E3
showcase. Yeah.
And which we've done 2 years in a row and has been a great experience for me and Raphael and Arcane both times. I mean, 2015, I mean, nobody really knew we were doing Dishonored 2. And so, unannounced, Raph and I came out, and I guess people figured it out when they, you know, saw that the two of us were together. But we were able to say, we're doing Dishonored 2, and Emily Caldwin is our lead protagonist, mm-hmm. and that was a great moment. And then last year, of course, we anchored the show, showing the gameplay for the first time. That was also great. But, you know, the fact is, I think we're just nerds. We're like those, you know the two or three people that start a craft beer place on the edge of town or whatever. They're total hipsters and they're into what they're doing, mm-hmm. and they make all these different brews and they can explain to you the chemistry behind it and all that. Like, we love games, like a lot of people do. We love games like that, you know, and so it's very hard for us to talk about that stuff without just nerding out. Now, that said, that went on for a while and I needed water halfway through it. My voice was breaking. And somebody ran up and gave me a bottle of water, which was great. But I got feedback later. I mean, surprisingly little feedback, by the way. So I still have no idea how people perceive that. So it's interesting to hear you talk about it. But I heard from some people who were like, you know, it was too wordy, too nerdy. I heard other people were like, oh, God, I could listen to that all day. You know, so it's like the internet.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I'm definitely in the latter camp. But especially because that was a show that didn't give designers and developers that much time to talk about their stuff. But like, it's a press show. It's a consumer facing show. So maybe I shouldn't be too surprised by that.
Yeah, that's always a trade off, isn't it? Like, how polished and slick are these things versus how much do they get back to the heart of what really is about games, which is the people who play games have, by definition, some sort of esoteric knowledge that's pretty deep about the experiences they have. So is it the equivalent of like filmmakers talking to film aficionados, or is it all marketing and press and all? And it's, you know, games are struggling back and forth with that, of course, and there's a need for both. And but yeah, I that's what I like about the showcase, is that it's a bit of both.
Harvey, I'm curious, you know, you've had this is the first sequel that you've worked on since Invisible War, probably?
Yeah, for me, this is an interesting moment in my 23 years in games. That's a good point. Because it's the first time since then that I have back-to-back worked on two games, right? Like, I've come in and worked on somebody else's sequel or whatever, but, like, this is the first time that I've had the opportunity to, like, work on a game for, you know, 3+ years, have it be very well-received, and then immediately roll into the sequel. And I know everything seems obvious from the outside or in retrospect, of course, always. Oh, they should have just done this or that, you know, and then nobody understands the constraints around what, on that day, what the constraints were. But I have to say, it's tricky. It's an interesting balance. And for Dishonored 2, I finally feel like we have that figured out. Our goal was to bring back the core things everybody loved, but of course try to deepen them or make them a little better, bigger. And I can talk at length about how I think we've done that. Add a few things, because there were a few things that, like, ambitiously we wanted to add to the package, and then take the four or five things that we got feedback that could have been better and try to, like, you know, fix those. And we read through tons of feedback from players. And so those three components are that's the way that we approach sequeling Dishonored.
Is that one of those things where, you know, I guess the thing I hear from developers a lot is, man, we got really good at making this game by the end. Like, we were bad at this when we first started. We knew what we wanted to evoke. We didn't know how to get there. And if you've spent a lot of times, they go from making that game to going to make something completely different. Was it an easy pivot from finishing Dishonored 2 to, like, all right, let's just keep this train going? Was there ever a moment where you felt fatigued by Dishonored?
Not fatigued at all. We love the Dishonored universe, and we love... Actually, this is one of the strongest fan community development cycles I've had. For almost 8 years, I've been interacting with Dishonored fans, and I always explain to people that Dishonored is not one thing. It's a bunch of overlapping circles. We have people who love stealth games, people who love immersive sims, people who like first-person shooters, people who love the Victorian setting, people who love the art, people who kind of like the touches of horror at the edges of it, you know, people who have latched onto a particular protagonist or some element of the story, people who like supernatural magic, people who like assassination games, you know. So it's people who like non-lethal and not being, you don't, it's a game right. about assassins where you don't have to kill anyone, literally. So it's a bunch of overlapping circles. I don't know if we ever feel that we're good at it, right? It's a struggle all the way through, and it's, you really have to go through the process on a game this big to see this thing that people allude to that's very true, that at the end, just in the final weeks of the project, it suddenly gets much better synergistically by a lot of little tying off and tuning and acknowledging that this is never going to change. You've got to do the best you can around it. And suddenly the whole thing, like, elevates in a weird way. But yeah, I mean, you know, I love Dishonored, so psyched to be doing the second one, and we hope everybody loves it as much as we love it, because it's bigger and better Dishonored, plus some new things, plus fixing some things that that we thought needed fixing.
You know, you mentioned having all of those different types of fans.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
When you come back and pitch Dishonored 2, how do you do that in a way where you don't feel like you're letting one group there down? Like, so you open that presentation at E3 by saying, in Dishonored, you play as a supernatural assassin in the steampunk city. The game blends combat, stealth, and mobility, giving you many different pathways and approaches, which is like, that's like two sentences, but in my heart of hearts, as someone who writes a lot, I bet that the writer, like, just broke themselves over those sentences until it was as tight and compact and as meaningful and as, like, yep, this is it. This is the core of the game. Two sentences. We have to say it in two sentences. But, like,
it's
when you
funny
hear that...
By the way, the writer was me and Rafael Colantonio. Like, we do sometimes work with a speech writer who helps us get our nerdy ideas packaged down. But, like, at the end of the day, we're very hard to work with, and we take back control and we make sure that what we're saying is from our hearts, you know, like, literally.
But
well,
it's like,
not literally, but you know what I mean? It's like, I mean that seriously, earnestly. Mm-hmm. So you're right in that way that, like, you take a class on somebody, tight with language, you know. I guess, Alice Walker is coming to mind, 'cause I love The Color Purple, and I just, I got halfway through Beloved a couple of times, and I'm that's the thing I'm trying to read now. But it's true of Shakespeare too. True of Nabokov, where, like, you read a sentence on surface and you kind of follow it, but then you go back and unpack it, and it means so many layers of things. And yes, that opening was deliberate, because it was like, look, this is not just some marketing presentation. This is like, we need to communicate to the people that are really listening for this. This kind of dog whistle, I guess, is the right term, right? Because we want to signal to people that, like, this is what you've been waiting for.
We're not leaving the combat behind. We're not leaving the stealth behind. We're not going... Is that a tough thing to do on the design side, too? Or is that... Like, I know when I do anything, I find myself with favorites with babies, right? Like, oh, this paragraph is the best, or this part of... We're launching a site here, right? And I can find myself on some days getting deeper into the nitty-gritty on, say, short-form video production than I can long-form video production. And it's in on paper, like, I need to be treating those with equal care, because both are very important parts of the strategy of launching the new site. But, like, I like being in front of a monitor with a video editor, and I like digging into that stuff. And if I don't check myself, that's a real risk. Is there something in Dishonored that is your, like, your draw? Like, it's the relic calling to you?
Yeah, it's funny that you say that. We have an organic strategy for that. It's too touchy-feely to call, like, a set of principles or whatever, but it's like what we try to do is have a fairly flat organization for most of the project, but with somebody like a creative director who can like step in and make decisions, and so nobody's stalemated. But our strategy there is to have people empowered in roles where they're doing their own thing, something they really love that they've gravitated to, where they become the champion for that thing, whether it's audio design, or whether it's the PS4 as a platform, or whether it's the stealth, or the melee sword combat, or the bone charm crafting, or whatever. There's an advocate, I guarantee you, or two, on every one of those teams. And that's my way of saying what you hear a lot, but it's really true, which is this is not one guy who starts out with a perfect vision and a bunch of drones execute that vision. It's, on both levels, that's not true, right? First of all, the vision changes constantly. It's a process. Vision is a process where, you know, you say some stuff and somebody challenges it, so you shift a little. You have to pivot a little. Well, okay, that's a little weaker, but he really responded to that part. And then you say it again, and she's like, oh, wow, she lit up when I talked about this part, so I'm going to, you know. And you just keep doing that for 3 years, and by the end, you look brilliant because you have this vision, right?
But the vision is collaborative from the jump.
From the jump, and if you're open. And then the other thing is the team members contribute so much. I've talked at length about, like, Dingo Bacaba is our lead designer. And I started thinking about this project on my own because the team was working on the DLC for Dishonored 1, and I kind of had one eye on that. Raph started thinking about the new game that he wanted to work on, but had one eye on the DLC as well. And so for a while, Dishonored 2 was just me thinking about it. And I had this leap about using Emily. Like, it wasn't an obvious thing, but we'd have to move forward in our timeline 15 years, and then it would work. And then I started pitching ideas. But the first person who really came in with me on Dishonored 2 and worked closely was Dingo Bacaba. And he contributed so much, and he's very much on top of the game design team. And we talk a lot about the powers and the mechanics behind them, and the combat and the stealth, the bone charm crafting, the difference between Emily and Corvo, the way they feel. And then, of course, we have Christophe Carrier, who's our level design director, one of the founders of Arcane, the best level designer I've ever known, just full of principles and stuff that have been true in games like Thief or System Shock or Deus Ex, Bioshock, but also the games he's worked on, Arx Fatalis, Dark Messiah, Dishonored 1. Dishonored 2. And then we have Sebastian Maton, our art director. We just have all these super strong guys, and they bring stuff. And on this project, we have Sashka Duval, who's my narrative designer, and she's been a total pleasure to work with, and she's brought a lot. She came in from the outside as a big fan of Dishonored 1, but with her ideas about how narrative could be changed in Dishonored 2. So basically, long-winded way of saying... you know, I work with all of these strong people who advocate, they champion their own little area, and that's part of the secret, I think.
Harvey, you mentioned that one of the things, you know, when you're kind of paying attention to what people are saying, you know, whether it's the critics or fans in terms of building a sequel, is that folks have a tendency to say, oh, you know, it's this is the very obvious thing they should have done. You know, they're of course they're going to do this. Why didn't they do this? Is there something specifically, because you mentioned that often people don't understand the constraints of production and the constraints of development and budget and things like that that probably go into what allow those decisions to be made, whether they're compromised or not. Like, is there something in particular that stood out that people were pointing to that you either addressed in the sequel or that's just kind of the way it was for a specific reason?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I could name a bunch of examples like on, you know, production, budget, time, technology. But, you know, just to pick one, once in a while I hear from people like, oh, I love Dishonored even. I hear, you know, from the people that really like it, but I really would like to be able to carry whatever I want in either hand and switch them out and do this in the left hand or that in the right hand and have two pistols, one in each hand, or two spells, one in each hand, or whatever. And that's a game design. You could make that game. That'd be cool. We opted not to do that for a very specific reason. And we, early on, we did actually test other models. Raphael and I, with our team in Austin, we did very early prototypes on like not having the sword in the right hand, for instance. And what we found was the way we wanted to tune the game otherwise, in terms of how fast the guards react, the fact that some guy might leap across the room and swing at you, the tension we wanted to create through those mechanics, putting you exactly in the right moment. You happen to be balancing on a railing above some guy and you have a split second to assassinate him and drag his body up onto the roof. No matter what else, it really helps to have a very quick, like 50 millisecond button that you can hit that blocks or assassinates. And so we put the sword in the right hand, and that's what goes in the right hand, and that's why. And it's cool to be able to put whatever you want in the left hand, like your crossbow or your pistol or the blink spell or devouring swarm or domino now or whatever. But like we adhere to that thing where, yes, dual wielding is cool. Yes, that other model could be made to work in a different game, with different timings and different tension and different goals. But in our case, to be able to block and throw a guy off balance with perfect timing to parry that blow, or to be able to move up behind your target and like feel that very vicious, like, I'm taking your life now, you know, and dragging you back into the shadows. Like, you need the sword in the hand all the time, you know?
My question is like the opposite of that, which is, that's a really good explanation for why a thing is the way it needs to be, or the way it is. It is the way it is. Is there anything where someone has issued criticism to you and your gut reaction is like, no, of course we have an answer. Of course it's not like that for this reason. And then a week later, you're up at night and it's still in your head and you're like, what?
Oh my God, 1,000 things. Yeah. I mean, like every time you hear criticism, you have that knee jerk reaction of like, you know, how dare you criticize me? No, that's wrong. But then given some thought, you're like, you know, they're kind of right. You know, there, of course there are things like that, you know? And like I said, Dishonored 2 is improvements on the core elements. It's a few new elements. And then it's course correcting on 4 or 5 things. And those 4 or 5 things probably represent what you're talking about, you know.
What's like one of those 4 or 5 things that comes to mind?
Well, for instance, we're big fans of our art direction and our style as led by Sebastian Miton and in the first project, Victor Antonov. Sebastian was art director of Dishonored 1 and 2. Victor was visual design director of Dishonored 1. And they work very closely together on the first game, and now it's been Sebastian solo in the second game. Well, I mean, with his giant, cool, talented art team, not one guy, but and on both projects, we have an assistant art director named Jean-Luc Monet. So we have some incredible art talent and in Lyon, but we're fond of our art direction and our style. It's a non-photorealistic, it sometimes resembles a painting but oddly realistic lighting at times, you know, so it's a combination of those things. And we heard on the first project some graphical complaints, and I immediately was just like, what are you talking about? I love this. I don't want our game to look like a photorealistic game. This is what we wanted to do. But then when you dig further into it, even if the players are not articulating it exactly the way I would, you realize that what they're talking about is maybe the rendering technology or whatever. And Most people care about the composite. They compare about the they care about the experience at the end. They're not. Most people don't get nitty gritty, which is why to some players, when they're complaining about one little thing that is the most important thing in the universe to them, they feel like we're ignoring it. But it's just like that little thing matters to you, and it doesn't matter to 99% of players. They care about the experience. But anyway, so for this project, we rewrote the technology underlying the game. We started with id Tech, and we rewrote, like, our engineering team, led by Oog Tardif, wrote like 95% of it again, and it's the Void engine, and it's what we showed off at E3, and it's what people are now playing in the hands-on events that we're holding across the world. And so that's an example of, like, initially feeling defensive, but then acknowledging that there was a very specific point in there somewhere. So we've preserved the art style, the signature art direction, but we've buttressed the rendering technology.
So speaking of feeling defensive, a thing I've seen from some people, and this is not unique to Dishonored, I don't think, is, like, at the announcement of Emily, obviously lots of people were really excited that you could play as Emily Caldwell, like, really great character in the first game. Caldwell. I love time jumps. What did I say?
You said Caldwell.
I'm terrible. I'm sorry. I'm the worst. I also saw people who were like, ugh, like, here they go again, bringing their SJW shit into video games. And, like, despite the fact that obviously you can continue to play as Corvo, Atano, that one I got right.
Yeah.
All right. That was a response that you'd see, and obviously you mostly see that on YouTube. You mostly see that on Facebook comments, on sites that have Facebook comments allowed. But, like, there is that murmur there that is, like, even the notion that you would offer that feels to them like you're bending to special interests, pandering. Exactly.
I guess I don't hear that too much because the voices I hear praising the fact that Emily seems to be presented as a cool character rather than as a sex object or whatever. The fact that she's an interesting character on her own, a dethroned empress on the run, who was the little girl in the first game that you really cared about because your playstyle was affecting her, disturbing her, or giving her hope or whatever, her drawings. And we've heard so much positive feedback about Emily that it drowns out anything else. And then we also do hear people, it has surprised me how much people love Corvo. And I mean that, like, we heard in the first game, he's a bit weird because he doesn't talk. He's silent, and therefore he maybe comes across cold. And so for the new game, we gave them both voices. So Emily is voiced by Erica Luttrell. Corvo is voiced by Stephen Russell, who played Garrett in the original Thief. And he's just like the perfect age and world weariness to play Corvo at in his mid-50s. And people have really responded. And there are people that, to my surprise, like, I'm like, hey, look, shiny new thing, cool Emily. New mechanics, new character, little girl from the first game. Don't you like that? You know, and a lot of people are like, yeah, that's what we want. But I've been surprised at the number of people that are like, Corvo's my guy. I got to see how 15 years have changed him and what he sounds like with a voice. And I want to eat people with rats and, I want to stop time and assassinate five people in the room before they know I'm there. And so there's a nostalgia factor that I've alluded to. But anyway, so to get back to your original question, though, like, man, the positivity we've received for Emily and also the for doing the ambitious thing of supporting both characters, because let me tell you, it has not been easy. It outweighs anybody's personal, conspiracy theory about why we did this. All I can tell you is that I was alone in a room and I was like trying to get myself there, if you know what I mean, right? Like, it's exciting to think about working on Dishonored 2 after the first one's successful. But you, as a creative guy, you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. You really have to find the thing that lights you up. It's not just, well, my life is so cool, I get to work on this super cool stealth assassination video. But you have to find the thing. And you find it over and over, right? Like, for me, it was, what if Emily was grown up? What would she be like? She would have been this privileged kid from a posh background, but she had this terrible tragedy where she watched her mother die in front of her. And how did she recover from that? And who did she become? And how would it change her to lose everything again? You know, and that stayed with me. That was like a lightning moment for me. And then finding the thing happens in other ways too, you know, like Dinga and I, when one of the artists on the team, Johan, pitched Domino, we try to reject everything basically because it means more work, right? We're like, yeah, that doesn't fit the filters or too much work or that's already been done by so-and-so game recently. But it was the kind of thing where we heard the pitch and we both went, huh. And then later, the next day, we came back in and Dinga was like, you know, I've been thinking about this idea that Johan pitched. And we began to shape it. We talk about the upgrades and how it would work and the UI for it, and other leads in other areas contributed heavily to it. And then we named it, and then we did the VFX for it. And now it's one of our favorite things in the game. And it got pitched by the lead technical artist, Johan. But, you know, you find over and over, whether it's Bone Charm Crafting or it's Emily as a character or it's the mission where you can travel in time is one of my favorite moments in the game, too, because you lose your supernatural powers. Mm-hmm. But you got to find that thing. And so I can tell you that almost everything we do comes from a pretty pure place. Like if it was cynical, like, oh, yeah, I guess this will sell some copies. it wouldn't survive because it's under constant attack on our team. Like if it's not cool enough to survive those attacks, it goes away, you know?
Is that the same with Karnaca, the new setting, which has like a very like colonial North Africa, Caribbean, Mediterranean vibe? Was that also a sort of a thing that was like, we can't just do Dunwall again. We have to find something else.
Well, yes. First of all, we've worked really hard to make it not a colony, by the way. The four nations are all sovereign states with their own independent rulers, collaborating together as an empire. So, because there were a lot of fictional tropes that would be cool to explore in a game, totally. I think, but that's not where we want it to go. Especially given that our protagonist was the Empress.
Yes, he didn't want the Empress coming to the colonies to save them. That's not really.
Yeah, it's like, this is a story of Grand Moff Tarkin. obviously there's some problems there, and we wanted to handle things differently, and so, you know, each nation state, it's its own sovereign power. Now, that said, Emily does come to the conclusion that some things have happened on her watch that should not have happened, you know. So, anyway, that I just have to throw that in there. But
I appreciate it. Oh, well, you know, that's one of those things where I think when you see that initial pitch, there was, it's an exotic, distant tropical locale. It's
right.
Pulling from that. So, it's that sort of steampunk now.
Right.
We did like dark, gritty Victorian. Now we're doing tropical, windswept beaches and silver mining and spices and erotic dances.
We also tried to avoid tropical. It's more Mediterranean. It's Greece and Spain and Italy. And where that came from was, to answer your question directly, I definitely wanted to start in Dunwall and do some missions in Dunwall and then go to a different place. And from Emily's perspective, it is a new place, right? It's a new part of the empire. It's the southern edge of the world. From Corvo's perspective, he's literally from there. He's always been an outsider or a foreigner in Dunwall, and he's going home after all these years. So I definitely wanted to do that. And Sebastian Matone led a lot of the moving it to Cirkonos instead, because I was initially thinking of Morley. I find Morley interesting because there's, you know, in Tivia, there's a council or a triumvirate. In Dunwall, there's a parliament. In Cirkonos, there's always a duke or duchess. But we always say that in Morley, there is always a king and a queen. And sometimes their agendas are at odds with each other. And so I find that politically really interesting if you had to do missions for one or both of them or alternate.
Dishonored 3, you heard it here first.
But Sebastian had a strong vision for this place at the southern edge of the world that resembled parts of Italy, parts of Greece. He had ideas about the waves of settlers that had come in from different parts of the world and the wind power because of the peak being split. And so we just rolled with that. Again, we have very strong leads and everybody has their say, and when the better idea wins out, generally.
Well, I want to keep talking to you about good ideas. I want to keep talking to you about windswept vistas and about all the different aisles of the game. unfortunately, we are out of time in the bunker today. We have to hand it off to someone else who is doing some VO work in here. We are still in the bunker for people who have been following along. We just have much better mics today, which is great. So thanks so much for coming on, Harvey. Thanks to Mitch, who is engineering this right now. Thanks to Tim, who is our new podcast producer. Thanks, Patrick, for calling in. And thanks to Bowen, who lets us use the wonderful track Miss You off of his EP, Pale Machine. I remember the name of the EP without having to look it up. That's good. Catch us again on Monday. Harvey, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you, guys. Dishonored 2 comes out 11/11/16. We're super excited. We hope everybody loves it as much as we do.
Great. All right, we'll see you on Monday. Peace.